Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel in the New Book Networks. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. The book Migrating Tales situates the Babylonic Talmud, or how we call it the Bavli, in its cultural context by reading several rich rabbinic stories against the background of Greek, Arabic, Persian, and other literature of late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, much of it Christian in origin. In this nuanced book, Professor Richard Kalman argues that non-Jewish literature deriving from the Eastern Roman provinces is a crucially important key to interpreting Babylonian rabbinic literature to a degree unimagined by early scholars. In our talk, we will speak about how a story and how tradition, which maybe imagine that they live in a bubble, actually influence and speak, argue, and have conflict and maybe also peace with other cultures. Professor Richard Kalman is teaching at the JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary. Richard, welcome to the New Books Network. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to take part.
Thank you. So my first question, I love the title of your book, Migrating Tales. And I wonder if you can share a little bit about your interest of going to this ancient and fascinating Jewish text, the Midrash, the Talmud, but you look at that from cultural point of view. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that.
I find the Talmud and the, in particular, the stories in the Talmud to be fascinating in and of themselves, but I find you get a much richer three-dimensional appreciation for the Talmud and for the Agadot by looking at the wider cultural context and by comparing the versions of stories and even motifs within stories that are in the Talmud with what you find in the surrounding cultures. So therefore you can examine them and see how the role that these stories play in the culture of, say, Christian culture, in pagan culture, Persian culture, Mesopotamian culture, all of those things, and compare that with what you find in Jewish culture. So if you're looking, you're comparing and contrasting the version of one with the version in a contemporaneous culture, you can see some of the fascinating differences and fascinating commonalities between the two cultures, between them actually the multiple cultures that were all flourishing at the same time in roughly the same place. And also you can get a sense of the wider history of the period by looking at the various places that these stories and these motifs started, or at least that we can identify them as starting. You know, they could have this prehistory, and probably a lot of them do, even though it's not currently accessible to us. So you can compare where they started to where they ended up. And then you can look you can look even further at where they went into the Middle Ages, into even the early modern period. You can trace it along those lines. And you get a sense of the currents, the directions that traditions were traveling in across the centuries and across the vast geographical areas.
Thank you. So when we think about the time of the text that you choose to your book, it starts around when?
Well, if you're talking about the Talmud, in the Babylonian Talmud, which is the Talmud that was produced within the Persian Empire between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is southwest Iraq, you're talking about a compilation that dates from roughly the 3rd century CE until approximately the 7th century CE. It has traditions there from much before that. Okay, a lot of them came from the land of Israel, starting from the 1st and 2nd centuries CE. But as I try to show in my book, it's not all within Judaic culture, far from it, that a lot of it comes from Christian culture, from Greek and Roman culture, in the what vis-a-vis the Jews in Babylonia is concerned, it's from the West. Okay, it also comes from various points within Persia. Okay, other parts of Persia, a corner of which the rabbis flourished, even within within Mesopotamia and within Armenia, both of which were heavily Christian parts of the Western Persian Empire, okay, in close contact with the Babylonian rabbis, that all finds its way into the culture of the Babylonian Talmud. And traditionally, the Babylonian Talmud has been studied really in isolation, virtually in isolation from other cultures, but particularly over the last 50 years, but even before that, people have been realizing just how much of Talmud comes from diverse contexts and is immersed in really the total cosmopolitan culture that that together represented the civilized world at that point.
So it's so interesting, and I want to try to get your help to understand how much these rabbis or these scholars were aware to these influences. So let's take an example from today. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we think about, as an Israeli, I think about the Israeli community, I mean, the Jewish community in Israel and the Jewish community in America. So the Jewish community in Israel, in a way, they believe or they have a feeling as if they are a bubble for itself, right? I mean, they don't think about how much we are influenced by the Middle East, right? Where we are part of now. However, when they think about American Jews, sometimes they said, oh, American Jews are so Americans, right? Mm-hmm. They're so Americans. They bring the Jewish humor that actually it's an American humor. They bring the value of academy. It's like so many things that Israelis think, oh, American Jews, they are Americans first. Mm-hmm. However, if they will look at on themselves, maybe they will find how much they became more and more part of the Middle East, mm-hmm. where you can see in the movies, in music, etc. So now let's go back to the Talmud.
Yes.
And the question is, how much self-reflection they have about themselves and also about their colleagues who are coming maybe from Babylon or are coming from other areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is a fascinating question. I would call that taking account of inflation. That's the $6,400,000 question. Because all of these ancient cultures, not just the Babylonian rabbis, but the Mesopotamian Christians, the Greeks and Romans, they don't like to admit that they are drawing motifs and stories from other places. Just to give you one of what could be countless examples, when you find a tradition in the Babylonian Talmud, it will either be introduced without context, okay? It'll just be introduced in the middle of a discussion about something really very tangentially related to it. But there it is. We aren't given any hint of where it comes from. So that's what contributed for so many centuries to the tendency of reading these sources in isolation from other sources. The other thing that is done very often is you'll have a tradition quoted in the Talmud, or a story quoted in the Talmud, which has very, very close parallels in another literature from another culture. But it will be introduced in the Bavli, which is another word for the Babylonian Talmud, by the way, with the introduction Tanu Rabbanan, okay, which means our rabbis taught. In other words, as far as the Babylonian Talmud is concerned, this tradition, which we know, okay, if we do the hard work of finding the parallels in another culture, actually originated, 1,000 years ago or 300 years ago the Eastern Roman provinces, okay? When I say that, I'm talking about, for example, Eastern Syria, I'm talking about Egypt, places like that. So that's its point of origin, at least as far as we can tell, looking at the available evidence, okay? When it gets to the Babylonian Talmud, they're hiding that. And they're telling us that this is simply a Tanaitic tradition, okay, deriving from the Palestinian rabbis, just like thousands and thousands and thousands of other traditions in the Bavli, and they're there's a very studied attempt to cover over its origin. And exactly what is behind that is not entirely clear. So that really, you know, your question goes to the root of that. And that's a very long and roundabout way of saying I wish I knew.
So in a way you say they hide it, but maybe they were aware.
Yes.
That, right. Yes. I mean, you can find somewhere that they have some self-awareness that mm-hmm. actually they adopted a different tradition, non-Jewish tradition.
Right, right. And also sometimes later commentators in the Talmud itself, you know, mm-hmm. later generations will respond to the story, okay, in ways that indicate that they could tell that this is foreign, you know, that this is not what we would expect our predecessors, our sainted predecessors, to say. So what's going on here? And they will attempt to domesticate it through commentary.
Now, since the first and second and third centuries, you know, they are so deep into the question of like beginning of Christianity, and actually some people will say this is the new beginning of the Jewish people as we know them, right, with the Purushim. Mm-hmm. And we have different sects. So do you feel that in that time you can find more awareness of how much there were choices inside the Jewish community, what to go, what to take from the past, where we say no, since maybe Christianity took this value, so we will take another value?
You definitely find that in many contexts where the Jews are insisting that, okay, these other people who shall be named nameless, okay, since they accept this opinion, okay, we are going to reject that opinion and accept a different one. Okay, you know, one of the stories that I treat in the Talmud, in my book, is a portrayal of Isaiah.
Yes.
Okay, and if you just look at that story in the Talmud, okay, it's about Isaiah. Okay, and these things happen to Isaiah. And by the way, according to the story in the Talmud, King Menashe, who is a very wicked king as portrayed in the Book of Kings in the Bible,
right,
executes Isaiah. And there's no hint of that in the Bible itself. But this is a tradition that developed independently of the Bible. Okay, so when you, for the rabbis, usually Isaiah is a great hero. But in this story, Isaiah is portrayed in ways that counter his usual portrayal as a hero. He's portrayed as a good deal less than heroic. And one of the points of the story is that Isaiah is not as great as he's usually made out to be. Okay? So that's why this story is concerned to criticize it.
Can you give an example for that?
Okay. He's portrayed as somebody who is not as important as Moshe. Okay. He's portrayed as someone who contradicts vitally important things that Moshe said. So for example, he says that the the Israelites did all kinds of horrible things, and God hated them for that. Okay. And if you look actually look at the prophets in the Bible, you see that there's a lot of very very scathing criticisms that the prophets make of the Israelite people. Okay. And it turns out that that was embarrassing to the Jews, okay, during the time that the Talmud was composed, okay? And the Christians, it turns out, okay, we can't tell that from the printed page of the Talmud, but we know if we look at Christian literature, contemporaneous Christian literature, that the Christians use that against the Jews. Your own prophets, who you consider saints, are saying horrible things about you. Okay, they say, you know, and again, you can find all kinds of quotations in the prophets about how God has rejected the Jewish people.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
That's one thing that this story that I write about has against Isaiah. Okay. Another thing that they have against Isaiah is that he, so what Moshe says that, and the Bible says that nobody can see God and live.
Right.
Okay? Right. That the Bible says that at one point. Okay. And however, Isaiah says, contradicting Moses, that I saw God seated on a high and lofty chair. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I myself saw him with my own eyes.
Right.
Okay. So that was another thing that the rabbis thought was horrible that Isaiah said. Okay. And it turns out that this story that I write about in the Talmud, portrays Menashe's execution of Isaiah as justified, okay?
By the Jewish law.
Yes. And right, exactly. So that Isaiah, it's true that he was a prophet, but he got too big for his britches. And Menashe put him in his place. So one of the puzzles of this story is, why would they portray Menashe in such a relatively positive way, given the extremely negative way that he's portrayed in the Book of Kings?
Right.
Well, then it turns out that in the Book of Chronicles, another book of the Bible, Menashe does tshuva, he does repentance, and he ends up being restored to his throne, and he lives happily ever after. So this Talmudic story is one of the relatively few places in all of rabbinic literature where we see how that portrayal of Menashe gets played out. Okay, so they cut Isaiah down to size, okay, which is not the way they usually portray Isaiah in the Talmud, and they build Menashe up, which is also not the way they portray Menashe in the Talmud, okay? And then we have this, it turns out then that we have the same tradition about Menashe executing Isaiah in Christian literature in another, in a bunch of places, okay? And there they portray Menashe as the heavy, okay? And Isaiah as the hero, because the Christians don't have a problem with Isaiah condemning the Israelites for being wicked, okay? They're perfectly fine with that, okay? And they also don't have a problem with Isaiah saying things that portray himself as superior to Moses. Because after all, okay, Moses, okay, he was okay as far as the Christians are concerned. But the later prophets, that's what Christianity really seized upon as spectacular, okay? They supersede Moshe, and what do? They make all kinds of prophecies about the coming of the Redeemer, about the coming of Jesus Christ, okay? And so what is a very positive story about Isaiah in the Christian literature is a negative story about Isaiah in Jewish rabbinic literature. So and it also turns out that the name Isaiah, Yeshayahu, which consists of the same basic consonants as the name for Jesus, Yeshu, okay, Yeshayahu and versus Yeshu, okay, the Christians interpreted anytime you find the root Yud Shin Ayin, Yesha or Yeshu, in the Bible, and you find a bunch of those cases in the Book of Isaiah. Okay, they find that as a reference to a hint to the coming of Jesus Christ. So my claim is that in this story in the Talmud, the rabbis are taking this same figure, Yeshayahu, and they're accepting it as a reference to Yeshu, but they view that as a negative, okay? And just as the Christian Messiah is killed by means of a tree or through a tree, okay, the crucifixion, okay, in the rabbinic story in the Babylonian Talmud, Isaiah is also killed, executed by means of through the aid of a tree, okay. But
inside the tree, right?
Excuse me.
He's killed also by a tree, but in a different way.
Yes, in a different way, right. The tree, by means of Isaiah saying the name of God, he is swallowed up by a tree,
right.
Okay? And then, however, his tzitzit are showing, okay, which is a sign that God wants Isaiah to be found by the king's men. So then he is sawn in half. That's how he dies, okay? He is sawn in half. And that's the motif that you find both in the Christian literature and in the Jewish literature. So, and he's sawn in half, and how does he die? At what point does he die? He dies when the saw reaches his lips, okay? And that's seen as the measure for measure punishment in both literatures, okay? Where in the Jewish literature, for example, the lips that Isaiah used to say all of those horrible, nasty things about the Israelites, that becomes the instrument for his death by means of the saw.
Which is fascinating, since we have also other examples in the Talmud, right, where heroes of the Talmud are killed and their tongue is there, right? Mm-hmm. It's cut like a chutzpit, I think, the translator, others, yeah. Which is so interesting. So actually, if I take what you just shared with us, which is so interesting, we have a debate, or we have a fight around who is going to be the right character and who is going to be the bad character. And what the other side is doing, I need to go against it. So I'm going to change my Bible by creating interpretation. And of course, we come back to the question, how much I am aware of that, or actually I think that I really interpreted the Bible in the right way.
Yeah, yeah, Right.
So this is such a good example to see how, as Christianity developed, we see the Jewish community also develop in trying to fight around tradition. Can you, I mean, and again, for the readers, I will, and our audience, I will deeply will suggest to go and read the whole book, because each chapter, what I loved about this book, that each chapter, you take an example and you really open it. Like you take it to, you analyze it with so much richness around. So I wonder if you can, Richard, take for us one more example of how Jewish culture or the Talmud is influenced by maybe farther traditions like Persians or the Romans in one of the many examples that you have there.
Okay. All right. Let's see. The well, there is one example that I talk about, which is a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
And Saint Bartholomew, right?
Yeah, and Saint Bartholomew.
I love that. Let's walk with that, please.
Okay. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai goes to Rome, and there is a persecution by the Romans of the Jews that they can't observe the Sabbath. They can't observe the laws of menstrual purity, etc.
And circumcision, I think, right? And circumcise. They're not allowed to circumcise their kids.
Right. Yes. They can't circumcise their children. Right. And first, there's this, actually, I think it's a hilarious scene where a rabbi, his name is Rabbi Reuven Istrobili, okay, who is known to interact with the Romans and dresses like a Roman. So he's kind of, part of his job is to pass as Roman, okay? And he's trying to convince them that all of their decrees against the Jews, okay, against the Jews observing their laws, are actually not in the Romans' best interest, okay? Because each of these laws, each of these observances, when the Jews perform them, it causes them to be weaker. Okay, so for example, if they're observing the Sabbath, they're idle. Okay, and they're not producing anything, so that makes them poorer. Okay, so therefore, it's not good to outlaw that. The Romans should be encouraging the Jews to do that. Okay, and it goes on like that. The mitzvah of circumcision weakens the Jews because they have to recover for it. It's painful. Okay, and that too, this rabbi says you should encourage them to do that because that weakens them. Okay, and it goes on and on like that. So the Romans think, that's an excellent idea, okay? And then they abrogate the decrees, but then they realize that Rabbi Reuven is Jewish, and then so they restore them, that he was just trying to hoodwink them, okay? But anyway, the storyteller is having a good laugh at the Romans because they thought, you know, they're being told to believe that all of these mitzvot weaken the Jewish people, when actually observing these mitzvot is what allows them to keep their covenant with God, which ensures their flourishing and their survival. Okay,
right.
All right. But anyway, so back to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He is sent to the Romans, okay, to the emperor, because he's a known miracle worker, Okay. Actually, this depiction of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as a miracle worker had a tremendously interesting afterlife into the even the modern world. Okay, with a lot of philosophical, a lot of Hasidic thought about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. But anyway, as far as Talmud is concerned. Okay,
so, which is fascinating, right? That you have this image of a rabbi that until today, and actually I think today in Israel, even more in the past, you have a celebration for his memorial day where 100,000 Jews will come to celebrate and have a whole perform. Right. But and he's a very, if I remember Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he's an example for an extreme against the Romans.
Yes.
General. Great.
Right. Yes. In another Agadah. Right. That's also in the background of this. Okay. But so anyway, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in this story misbehaves in a lot of really serious ways. And one thing that you will find in story after story in the Bavli is the way the rabbis love to depict themselves with all kinds of horrible shortcomings. Okay. They are, you know, on the one hand, they're larger than life and they can behave like saints, but also they can behave like tremendous anti-heroes and do all kinds of horrible things. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in this story is portrayed as plagiarizing. Okay, he passes somebody else's teaching off as his own, which is just about the worst thing a rabbi can do. Short of murder. Okay, this is horrible. To deny somebody's intellectual property is just unforgivable. Okay, and what else does he do? He had promised not to hurt another rabbi who goes along with him to try to convince the Romans to stop the persecution. Okay, and this other rabbi, whose name is Rabbi Elazar, agrees to go with Rabbi Shimon, but then Rabbi Elazar's father says, "No, I don't want Rabbi Shimon going with my son because I don't trust him." In other words, he's more afraid of Rabbi Shimon and what he will do than he is of the Romans. Okay, and lo and behold. Okay, it eventually happens that the two of them are going together, okay, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. And Rabbi Shimon gets furious with Rabbi Elazar. And as a result of that, he curses him, okay? The father's tremendous worry was actually turns out to have been justified.
Right.
Okay. So what else does Rabbi Shimon do? Finally, he meets up with this character, Ben Talamion, okay, which judging from parallels in Arabic sources and it in the literature of other cultures, seems to be a Hebrew and Aramaic way of referring to the word, to the name Bartholomew. Okay, Ben Talamion Bartholomew. Okay, Ben Talamion is portrayed as a demon who suddenly appears to the rabbis, and offers to help them. Okay, so you may think, well, what is a demon offering to help rabbis? I thought demons were evil. Well, it turns out that in the ancient world, a lot of times demons were either neutral or even positive. Okay, and so this is a positive demon. And why is it? Why is his name Bartholomew? Well, I have a theory about that, which I'll talk about in just a second. So Rabbi Shimon is, when he sees the demon offering to help, he is extremely upset, okay? Because he says, look, you read the Bible and a character like Hagar, you know, a maidservant, right? She gets an angel comes to speak with her, but all I got is a demon.
And I have a demon.
Yeah, all I have is a demon. So, but in the end, he agrees to go with the demon, to accept the demon's help. And so again, I think that that is part of the transition in the story, which depicts Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as finally learning his lesson, finally learning to behave himself, okay? Learning the humility necessary in order to help the Jewish people get out of this horrible persecution, okay? So the demon accompanies them to Rome. Turns out that the emperor's daughter is possessed by is sick. Okay, she's sick. So the demon takes possession of her body. He inhabits her body. Okay, and then the idea is that Rabbi Shimon is supposed to say, you know, he's supposed to exorcise this demon. So this is an agreement they had beforehand, okay? So Rabbi Shimon says, get out of her, leave, okay? So the demon obediently leaves, and lo and behold, the emperor's daughter is cured. The emperor is ecstatic, and he offers the rabbis whatever they want, okay? So what they want is the end to the decrees, which was a very important gesture on their part, because they could have asked for tremendous riches, okay? Because you find this same motif of a rabbi or a holy man performing a miracle for a leader and being rewarded with enormous riches, but Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Elazar only ask for the end to the persecutions. Okay, so this is a sign. So this, together with his behavior, with accepting the offer of help from the demon, that's a sign that he has learned his lesson. Okay, and all right. So finally, how is this story relevant to me? Because once again, you have these same figures, these same stories told in other cultures. And where does Bartholomew come from? Bentholomew. My theory is that comes from the name of one of Jesus's disciples in the New Testament. And all we know about this Bartholomew in the New Testament is that he, like all of the other apostles of Jesus, is an exorcist. Okay, but they have. So why do they choose Bartholomew, who is certainly all he is he's a cipher in the New Testament. He's just a name. Okay, it turns out that Armenian Christianity, okay, which is basically a hop, skip, and a jump distant from the Babylonian rabbis in the Persian Empire, they had adopted Bartholomew as their patron saint.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So so this is a way for the rabbis to use Armenian Christianity, this vitally important figure in their practice of their religion, okay, Bartholomew, as a tool to think with. Okay, so they make Bartholomew no longer an apostle, okay, an exorcist. Rather, they make him out to be a demon, which in the history of religions is a very common phenomenon, where one religion will adopt an angel or a hero or even a divinity from one religion and demote him to a demon. Okay, so that's my theory about what's going on in this story, that they're taking this motif, which partly comes from the New Testament, which was produced in the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire, and this the figure of this apostle Bartholomew, which comes from Armenia, which is much closer geographically to the rabbis, and together with that you get this that's the seed from which this entire elaborate story arises.
And then can we find any sources in the Armenian Christianity who knows about the use of the rabbis, of their hero as a demon? And is there any dialogue that is happening with that?
Unfortunately, no. I have not been able to find that yet, but I'm still looking.
Fascinating. So, Richard, thank you so much. I really love how you take a story, but then not only explain what other scholars show us in the story, but you also really open it like as a Wikipedia to a different layers of influences and dialogues and competitions, right, between traditions. Mm-hmm. Richard, thank you so much for being in the New Books Network.
Thank you very much. And by the way, want to put in one small plug.
Please.
My book is coming out in paperback.
Great.
In the middle of May of this year.
So we can find it in both in hardcover and in paper very soon. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me.